Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories.
The war on Iran is going badly for Trump. Mixed reactions of NATO partners to the U.S. attacks on Iran. And Trump intensifies pressure on Mexico and Cuba. First, Trump at war. Trump's aggressive war is not going as he expected. His model for victory, the Venezuela kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro, has proven spurious. Against Iran, a far better armed and organized foe, Trump has been denied a quick win. The U.S. has suffered casualties. Iran has retaliated across the region. Several days of intense bombing have failed to bring about Iran's unconditional surrender. All Trump can do is keep destroying a country that poses no immediate threat to the U.S. and is not on the verge of building a nuclear bomb. Trump was informed by his National Security Council days before he launched the attack on Iran that no level of military pressure was likely to dislodge the Khomeini regime. The administration's claim that U.S. intelligence showed Iran was preparing to attack U.S. targets was patently false. Thus, the assassination of Ali Khomeini and 40 other senior Iranian officials has led not to surrender, but to the accession of Khomeini's son, whose ties to the Revolutionary Guards suggest that he might be even more brutal than his father. Trump is guilty of major strategic errors besides the misuse of the Venezuela model. He thought the U.S. and Israeli attacks would arouse Iranians to rise up and overthrow the Khomeini regime. "When we are finished, take over your government," Trump said to no one in particular. "It will be yours to take." Trump thus vastly underestimated the repressive power of Iran's security forces. Trump also has obviously erred in believing that a few days of bombing would eliminate Iran's capacity to cause damage in Israel and beyond. The Trump regime has also discounted the global impact of the war. The Middle East has been the most affected. Oil prices, shipping lanes, Asian and European energy needs, stock markets, and the international economy generally have all been negatively impacted by the war. Iran's ability to choke off oil tankers in the Strait of Hormuz apparently was not considered likely by war planners. Russia and China are also involved in the war. Reports indicate that Russia is helping Iran target U.S. air bases, and Iranian ships are loading key ingredients in rocket fuel at a Chinese port. Finally, Trump never gave negotiations a chance to succeed. His desperation to score a major win that might rescue his administration has instead given further reason, especially to his supporters, to abandon this warmonger who has gone against all previous promises. Give credit to the Netanyahu government in Israel. Its insistence on destroying Iran, and just the other day saying Israel will kill any new leader of Iran, has led Trump down the war path. Netanyahu has used the war to solidify his power and quite possibly escape punishment for his corruption, just as he did in the war with Hamas. He has also used the war to expand Israel's security perimeter in Lebanon, where the war with Iran has displaced at least 600,000 people. Joseph Aoun, the Lebanese president, said Lebanon was trapped between an Israeli assault which, quote, shows no respect for the laws of war, and Hezbollah, quote, an armed group operating outside the law in Lebanon, which has no regard for the interests of Lebanon and the lives of its people. There is no getting away from it, however. This is one person's war. Trump has terribly miscalculated and finds himself in the worst of situations, carrying out a war that expands by the day, but with no endgame, and failure to achieve either regime change or elimination of Iran's nuclear capability. As Senator Chris Murphy reported after a briefing on the war March 10, the administration's only option is to keep bombing. If Trump is smart, he'll declare victory, stop bombing, withdraw U.S. forces, return to negotiations, and tend to his East Wing ballroom. Mixed reactions of NATO partners to the U.S. attacks on Iran. The response of NATO allies has been both disappointing and encouraging. Canada was quick to endorse the attacks on Iran. Prime Minister Mark Carney justified them, quote, with regret, because the current conflict, note he didn't say war, is another example of the failure of the international order. It seems to me that his comment is part of that failure. Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz would only say that he had urged Trump to link the wars in Iran and Ukraine, since both involve the fight against security and justice. Really? France's Emmanuel Macron was a bit better. He said that while Iran bears primary responsibility for the war, the U.S. attacks were, quote, outside the bounds of international law. Yet France has put ships into the Strait of Hormuz in support of international shipping. Only Spain and Britain really put words into action. Spain denied the U.S. use of joint bases on its territory for U.S. attacks on Iran. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said, quote, "You cannot play Russian roulette with the destiny of millions. You can't respond to one illegality with another, because that is how humanity's great disasters begin," unquote. Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer remains adamant in the face of Trump's criticism for also refusing to allow use of the U.S. base in Diego Garcia for bombing runs in Iran. Trump intensifies pressure on Mexico and Cuba. Throughout the months in which the Trump administration threatened Venezuela's Maduro and Cuba's leadership, the president also publicly suggested that he might send U.S. troops into Mexico to deal with the drug cartels. You might think that after Mexican forces, apparently backed by U.S. intelligence help, killed the head of the Jalisco New Generation cartel in an attack that left 62 dead, including the cartel leader, Trump would have eased off on his threat. Instead, Trump posted on social media that, quote, "Mexico must step up their effort on cartels and drugs." Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum has responded that the U.S. needs to rein in gun trafficking, pointing out, as Mexico has many times in the past, that, quote, "if the U.S. stopped the entry of illegal weapons from the U.S. into Mexico, those groups wouldn't have access to this type of high-powered weaponry to carry out their criminal activities," unquote. But Trump wields a big stick, tariffs, and what remains of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement. Regime change in Cuba may be the next stop for the Trump war machine. Here's what he told CNN in an interview March 6, quote, "Cuba is gonna fall pretty soon. They want to make a deal, and so I'm going to put Marco," that's Marco Rubio, "over there, and we'll see how that works out. We're really focused on this one," meaning the war with Iran, "right now. We've got plenty of time, but Cuba's ready. I've been watching it for 50 years, and it's fallen right into my lap because of me. It's fallen, but it's nevertheless fallen right into the lap, and we're doing very well," unquote. The Justice Department followed up by indicting a number of Cuban officials and entities for their alleged involvement in drug trafficking, as usual presenting no evidence. Seemingly in contradiction with Trump's threat, the U.S. Treasury Department said it would authorize companies seeking licenses to resell Venezuelan oil to Cuba. That might help relieve Cuba's energy crisis, which U.S. control of Venezuela's oil has contributed to worsening. However, there's a catch. Cuba apparently will still have to come up with cash and bank assurances in order to get the oil. Why did the Treasury Department make the announcement? Some Latin American countries let the U.S. know of concern that instability in Cuba could affect the entire region. In other news, two items from the Ukraine war. The U.S. fails to water down a U.N. resolution on the Ukraine war, and Hungary blocks European Union aid to Ukraine. As the war enters its fifth year, the U.N. General Assembly voted to reaffirm support for a, quote, "just and lasting peace, an immediate ceasefire, and for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity." The U.S. tried to remove references to the last two parts, but it was voted down overwhelmingly. The resolution supporting Ukraine passed by 107 votes in favor, 12 against, and 51 abstentions, with most of Europe favoring it, and abstentions from the U.S., Russia, China, and many Global South countries. The Trump administration also supported Russia by filing an official complaint that formally warned Ukraine not to strike targets within Russia that could hit U.S. economic interests, according to Kiev's ambassador to Washington. The attack on a Black Sea port damaged two tankers that form part of Moscow's so-called Shadow Fleet, but also hit a terminal partly owned by Chevron and Exxon. Yet Trump has no problem asking for and getting Ukraine's very effective anti-drone weapons to defend U.S. bases in the Middle East. As for Hungary, it is blocking a $105 billion European Union loan to Ukraine, putting a crimp in the EU's effort to demonstrate that it doesn't need direct U.S. aid to Ukraine to keep Ukraine in business. The EU says the bloc and its member states have so far provided Kyiv with over $220 billion in support during the war. Viktor Orban, Hungary's leader for 16 years and a Trump champion in Europe, has used veto powers to position himself as the EU's disruptor-in-chief and wield outsized influence within the 27-nation bloc. Orbán is up for re-election, and the Trump administration is essentially campaigning for him, for instance, by sending Secretary of State Rubio to visit him last month, and by granting Hungary exemption from sanctions on purchases of Russian oil. Hungary said it was blocking the EU decisions because of disruption to a pipeline that delivers Russian crude oil to Hungary and Slovakia through Ukraine. Hungary contends that Ukraine has deliberately obstructed the oil flow. We have entered the era of water bankruptcy. Water bankruptcy is the term being applied to a time when demand for water permanently exceeds local supply from rivers, lakes, rainfall, and groundwater. Kaveh Madani of the United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment, and Health finds that we are beyond a water crisis or emergency to a time, quote, when the crisis never ends. Human overuse of water, population pressure, and especially climate change, desertification, biodiversity loss, etc., all play a role, he says. At the same time, glaciers have melted and ice storage is depleting globally. This dire situation is irreversible. The way agriculture is organized worldwide has much to do with water bankruptcy. A writer who reports on Madani's study puts the situation this way, quote, to feed just one average person per day takes 950 liters of water, 12 kilos of lost soil, 1.6 liters of fossil fuel, 1 gram of highly toxic pesticide, and 4.9 kilos of carbon emissions. Multiply these numbers by 8.3 billion people, and then by 365 days in the year, and you will begin to sense the problem. Water is merely the resource that is running out fastest, but hot soil and a safe climate for food production are not far behind, unquote. About 24 countries and most of the world's megacities are in trouble. The top 20 cities include Beijing, Shanghai, Tianjin, New York, Los Angeles, Mexico City, Lima, and Sao Paulo. The Japan-China feud heats up over missile deployment. The brief tenure of Japanese Prime Minister Takeuchi Senai has been marked by rising tensions with China. It began when she made an unprecedented commitment as a matter of Japanese sovereignty to help defend Taiwan if China attacked the island. That led to various Chinese trade measures directed at Japan. Then Takeuchi won a supermajority for her party in parliamentary elections. She has used that to promise major increases in military spending, obviously with China in mind. Now, her defense ministry has announced that it will deploy surface-to-air missiles in a remote island in the Okinawa chain by 2031, only about 70 miles from Taiwan. China is protesting. A dispute over Sudan between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates heats up after a Trump phone call. The United Arab Emirates, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia are well known to be supplying arms to opposing groups in Sudan's civil war. Trump called Saudi Arabia's de facto leader, Mohammed bin Salman, and was asked by bin Salman to sanction either the UAE or sanction the rebel group. The call has led to serious feuding between the two countries that are allied with the U.S. The Emirates have been the target of international criticism for backing the rapid support forces in Sudan with arms and drones. The RSF has carried out horrendous attacks on civilians. The UAE denies all this, but fact is that its support of the RSF is part of larger ambitions in Africa directed at undermining Islamist regimes, such as Sudan's. The Saudis also have ambitions, but they are confined to commercial leadership in the Middle East. The two countries have already clashed over the Houthis in Yemen, with the UAE siding with the Houthis and the Saudis regarding them as threats to national security. The United States has said little about the Sudan civil war, but after a meeting with bin Salman, Trump said, quote, His Majesty would like me to do something very powerful having to do with Sudan. We're going to start working on it. That comment didn't make the UAE leadership very happy. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.